the Allstate Skyline Studio.
WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything within the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this edition of the Sunday Spin for February the 10th, 2019. Thanks for tuning in to our weekly look at the world of politics and policy, going from City Hall to the State House and all the way out to the White House. Time to grab that Sunday paper, get that hot cup of coffee, and we'll do our best to get your week off to a great start. Well, it's hard to believe the Super Bowl was a week ago, you know, but
are you awake from it yet?
Yeah, but then again, exactly. It was so unmemorable that it's probably worth forgetting. And I know, you know, there are those who say it was a great defensive struggle, and
It wasn't.
It was just inconsistent offense. It was just a kind of a sad way to say goodbye to football.
Yeah, those that tell you there was a good defensive battle are just trying to justify it in their own minds for having to sit there and watch it.
Yeah.
It's unlike a 1-0 baseball game where there's actual strategy and some key moments and things of that nature, and it just seemed like neither offense could get anything going, and it was just boring.
It was very boring.
I hate to say that as a sports fan and a sports caster, but it was boring.
Well, and, you know, it's all about the Super Bowl, you know, for football season, it's all about the Super Bowl, mm-hmm. and that was it. And it's like, it just so unsatisfying, you know?
Yeah, and I think it was even worse for Bears fans knowing that they were... They should have been there. You know, I think they were still the better team.
That was certainly in people's thoughts all through the game.
Yeah. Right.
And then watching as Gostkowski and Zuerlein were making field goals, although I felt bad for Zuerlein. And I felt bad for me, too, when he missed that field goal at the end of the game because we were playing those squares.
See, I was just going to bring this up.
And I got totally rooked out of some big cash going because he missed that field goal.
That was the only thing I was thinking of, truly, was about 5 seconds left in the game. Is that was like the most exciting part was thinking of people who were playing squares
mm-hmm.
and either had 3-3 and thinking about the already counting the money.
Yeah, I was counting the ways I was going to take my parents out to dinner. I was visiting them in Florida and I was ready to take them out to dinner. It was that much money that I could have won and it just didn't happen.
Yeah, I mean, it was even that bad. It was like, that was, like I said, that was the most exciting moment.
Yeah.
Even, you know, even in a squares game, there was not that much to, you know, there weren't a lot of, everybody talked about what a high-scoring game it was going to be or a lot of scoring going on, which, you know, makes the square game kind of fun.
Yeah.
Nothing.
No, and the same person won twice, I think. I think the end of the quarters, I think it might have been the same numbers.
I'm not sure. That's how memorable it was. I think first quarter was 0-0, and second quarter it might have been 3-0.
I think it was 3-0.
Yeah, that's what it was.
So, yeah.
Wasn't a real touchdown until the third quarter, right?
The only touchdown.
Yeah. Yeah. Just pathetic. Mm-hmm. But at least it's nice to know in kind of this vacuum with no football. Let's look at those Blackhawks,
Let's look at them.
7 in a row today. That'll be their 7th victory in a row today when they beat the hated Detroit Red Wings.
The old Dead Wings are in town.
Yeah.
They've lost a couple in a row. And,
be nice now.
No, it's because, you know, the
why do you think they say Detroit sucks at the United Center?
Okay? And, you know, I will say this until I can't talk anymore, that the Red Wings just chickened out by going to the Eastern Conference. Oh, it's a one-hour time difference.
Yeah.
please.
And they've been playing some great hockey, too.
Yeah, I agree.
The other night, what was that? Tuesday night when they were playing Edmonton.
Mm-hmm.
And they're losing 2-1 going into the third period. And truly, before you can stop blinking, they score 5 goals.
Yeah, and like, what, 3 minutes?
Well, I think
5 minutes?
Three minutes, something like that. And I will tell you, thank you, Blackhawks, for waiting until after the State of the Union address to light the goal lamp, okay? Because it was...
perfectly timed.
Absolutely. It was the speech is done, and I flip over to the hockey game, and wow, it was just fantastic. And I mean, they're just playing so much better. The power play is...
It's lethal now.
Yes. I mean, it's like... And I know it's easy to sit back and watch a game on TV or listen to John and Troy do it on the radio, and you know you're not on the ice, you're mm-hmm. not. But the way that power play and the rotation is going, and the passes are being made,
yeah, not a lot of standing around.
No, and you can't stand around. That's the whole secret to mm-hmm. it. Just so much better. And. You know, we can keep talking probably till the end of the season. We're only 4 points out of the last playoff spot, right, or whatever. And the one thing I want to caution everybody is, one, remember we have 9 overtime mm-hmm. points.
And that's tiebreaker. That's one of the tiebreakers.
9, okay? And so that's costly on the win-loss side. 2, St. Louis, I think the Blues are in the, as of right now, the last playoffs.
They are, and they've won 5 straight.
And they also have played 2 fewer games.
Yeah, they have 2 games in hand.
And so keep that in mind as well. I mean, the Hawks have played 55, and I think the Blues played 53 games. So, mm-hmm. you know, these are all factors to keep in mind when people say, well, they're just an eyelash away from the playoff spot. They're in playoff contention.
They are.
But... You know, take a little bit of a reality check here, right, and look at the context.
And the other thing to consider, too, they have a couple of teams yet to jump over to get to that spot.
Right.
You know, Colorado being one of them, who's just a couple of points ahead of the Blackhawks in the division. So there's a lot of things that are kind of working against them a little bit. But I tell you what, it's been nice to watch. As you point out, they're playing good, clean hockey the way that the fans of Chicago have gotten used to over the years. And, you know, say what you want about Coach Jeremy Collin. I think it just took him a little while to get the ear of some of these guys, and give credit to guys like Jonathan Toews and Duncan Keith and Seabrook and Kane for buying in and, you know, not making any waves when the only coach they all knew pretty much was Joel Quenneville. And when he was released in November, you didn't really know what kind of team this was going to be going forward. And there's been so many accolades, you know, handed on and placed on Jeremy Collin for his coaching ability. He's calm, cool, and collected there behind the bench. And I tell you what, he's got these lines playing, and I think he's got the good combinations now where you can roll 4 lines. And anybody will tell you that watches the NHL with regularity, 4 lines usually equals a good streak and a good time at the hockey rink.
Well, and they needed a streak.
Yeah, you're right.
The only streaks we had were losing streaks, and mm-hmm. they needed a win streak. And my God, they're on it, you know.
Yeah.
And it is also something to say, too, is that when you have – you know, Keane and Toews playing on the same line, mm-hmm. you know, used to be spread the wealth.
Yeah, it used to be called the nuclear option.
Right. But now it's a regular option. And I'd been very critical of the Hawks' defense.
Mm-hmm. It's gotten a lot better.
Yeah, to the point that you can play Keith and Seabrook together.
Right.
The way it used to be. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, the emergence of Eric Gustafson has really made a difference in that respect. I mean, Henry Jokiharju is back in the minors to try to develop a little bit more. You know, there's one guy that I like. I usually pick out one defenseman to pick on all year.
Yeah.
For years, it was Johnny Oduya, just because he used to turn the puck over all the time. This year, 42 in red, and that's Gustav Forsling. But he's had some injury issues, and I think he's, you know, he's still a young player as well. But you know, that depth has really allowed Jeremy Collin to do what you said, and that's play the two old grizzled veterans together. And we can't discount the goaltending the way that it's gone too, with Cam Ward, former Stanley Cup winner with the Hurricanes, and also the youngster Colin Delia, have been playing very well in the absence of Corey Crawford, who, again, I mentioned in the sportscast, returned to practice yesterday.
Yes, and I mean, patience,
yeah,
obviously.
I'd be surprised, you know, if there's any real urgency to get him back on the ice if they're not in a playoff contention situation. If they feel like they're going to get there, it wouldn't be a bad idea if he's physically and ready to go to get him out there. But it's a crapshoot, because 2 concussions in less than a year,
right,
is nothing to mess around with.
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. I mean, I think we've all learned about that. And, no, it's just fun to watch, though.
I agree.
And a great Original Six matchup going on today at the United Center, a pregame with Chris Bowden at 1:30, and then John Troy have the puck drop at 2 o'clock, and I'll be watching.
This will be the 736th meeting between these two Original Six franchises.
Wow. And what's the record?
I'm glad you asked. I have that right here in front of me. Let's see. 283, 357, 84, and 11. So the Hawks are a little under 500. Well,
you don't miss anything, do you?
No, I try to be prepared, you know.
You knew if he was going to say what meeting number it was,
yep, he had to be prepared for the breakdown.
It's like it's like the old lawyer trick. Don't ask a question you don't know the answer to. So I told you the answer, and now I have the answer to your other question.
Well, I'm looking forward to a great game this afternoon. I hope the weather stays pretty decent. I know we've got snow in the forecast, although not an inch or two, perhaps.
Yeah, a 1 to 2, but tomorrow.
Yeah, now you're worrying. Now you're worrying me with
perhaps
that.
Perhaps some freezing rain because the temperatures will be hovering right at that level, and so that's something to watch tomorrow. We were spared. What was it, Tuesday or at night or Wednesday night of last week? We were spared what could have been a real ice situation here, but we didn't get it. It was just warm enough where we didn't get all of that freezing. However, our friends in Michigan, they've been hit and hit hard with ice. In fact, I heard from a friend in Battle Creek, Michigan, yesterday, and they're stuck in their house, no power and ice.
And really, that ice is nasty. I mean,
terrible.
Going to school around the St. Louis area, and that's all I remember.
You know, they get it there.
The freezing rain and ice, and I think I've told you the story. I'm going over to SIU Edwardsville to go to classes, and they did not cancel school, and it was
slipping and sliding.
It was literally the freezing rain was coming down that the defroster on the car could not keep up with it. So I pull the car over to the side of this not busily traveled road, pull the car over to go scrape the windshield. And it was on a bit of an incline. And I opened the car door of my trusty 1973 Camaro.
That was my next question. Yes. What year are we talking about?
Well, we're talking around, you know, 78, 79.
Well, the year of the car, though,
was 1973. Yeah, okay. Camaro. And
you still have that, don't you?
Trust me, I don't.
I thought I saw you driving around.
No. But I open the door of the car to get out, and as I'm getting out, I lose my footing.
Uh-oh.
And slide underneath the car door.
Oh, that can be terrible.
And go all the way, like, 40 feet, you know? And the worst part wasn't exactly the falling down and sliding. It was trying to get back up to my car.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Good luck with that.
And, of course, I finally make it to the car. I'm cursing out every school official I can think of at SIU Edwardsville.
Yeah.
And then on the radio comes, classes have been canceled today at SIU
Edwardsville. Now they tell you.
Yeah, exactly.
Now they tell you.
Isn't that the way life works, you know?
Yeah.
It just
I remember driving home from Ball State on I-65 in the middle of a terrible ice storm. You could not go over 20 miles an hour. And there were so many spin-outs, so many cars in the ditch. That was just a very, very treacherous ride home for Easter weekend.
Yeah, we had one when I was living in Peoria in 1990. I think it was Valentine's Day. And my apartment complex was on a hill. And there was it kind of worked its way up.
Yeah.
So I was in the middle level. And then there was a lower level, and the incline couldn't have been more than, you know, it wasn't really that steep. But I could not get up the incline in my 1989 Honda Civic. And there was literally a parking lot of banged up cars at the bottom of this because nobody could get up to their apartments, and everybody slid back down into the
car lower that area. Was there before.
Wow. Yeah. So it was like a smash 'em up derby.
Oh, jeez. Yeah.
It's
truly
nothing to mess with.
It is not anything to mess with at all.
It can be worse than snow.
It is worse than snow.
I agree.
It absolutely worse than snow. Well, but at least on the good weather front, is it appears that we're going to be at or above freezing for the rest of the week.
Pretty much. Yeah. Yeah. What they call seasonal temperatures.
Yeah. What's that like?
Seasonal
right?
temperatures.
what, wait a minute, this is Chicago. Yeah. There's no such thing.
What does that mean?
Yeah, there's no such thing. Oh, man. Well, Dave's here to keep us up to date on all the news. Andy, of course, has the latest sports. Producer Cassara is fielding your calls at 312-981-7200. You can also text us at that number, 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. And we're on Twitter at symbol Sunday Spin. Engineer Bob is trying to figure out what seasonal means here in Chicago. Remember, you can find all of our shows on WGNRadio.com. You can also get our podcasts at iTunes by searching for my name, Rick Pearson. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson. Up ahead on the spin, after the 7:30 news and sports, we'll speak to my good friend Jason DeSanto. Jason is a senior lecturer at Northwestern University, and he specializes in political rhetoric and messaging, and we'll talk about the president's State of the Union address last week, as well as some of the messaging that's been going on in the Chicago mayoral campaign. After the 8 o'clock news and sports, we'll have a special panel with some good friends of mine as part of our annual commemoration of Black History Month in February. Martha Jo Black, who is involved with fan experiences for the Chicago White Sox, and she's the author of a book about her father, Joe Black, More Than a Dodger. We'll be joined by her, Stephanie Carew, the daughter of Hall of Famer, Minnesota Twins first baseman Rod Carew, and by Patty Green, the daughter of the late football coach Dennis Green. And we'll kind of talk about family, what family means, the importance of family, particularly in the African-American community, and how family can be important in overcoming the challenges that those communities face. And then we'll close out the show with my good friend, Dave Heinzman. Dave is a Tribune colleague of mine. He recently wrote a background piece about the financial issues that are surrounding Chicago mayoral candidate Amara Enya. And we'll talk about his story, what he discovered, and some of the aftermath that ensued from that story. That's all up ahead. Right now, though, we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN.
This is The Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Skyline studio, joined by good friend and noted, noted senior lecturer, award-winning senior lecturer at Northwestern University in the School of Law and Communication.
Right, right. Jason and you're, if, you know what, if you are noting it, Rick,
yes,
then it's worth noting.
Then it's noted.
That's okay. It's noted.
Well, I want to make sure I got the rhetoric right, because that's kind of up your alley here.
It's something I've been doing for a long time. Happy to do it here.
Well, I appreciate you coming in, particularly since, obviously, last week we had President Trump's State of the Union address. And I want to play one cut from that initially. And then I want to tell you my thoughts of the speech, but then I want to hear you know, having analyzed it, what your thoughts were. But you had the president lashing out about the investigations that are being launched by Democrats now that they control the House, not only of Russia, but also his personal finances, his tax returns. Here's how the president kind of characterized this.
Together, we can break decades of political stalemate. We can bridge old divisions, heal old wounds, build new coalitions, forge new solutions, and unlock the extraordinary promise of America's future. The decision is ours to make. We must choose between greatness or gridlock, results or resistance, vision or vengeance, incredible progress or pointless destruction. Tonight, I ask you to choose greatness.
So, I know he's big on alliteration.
Yeah.
But one thing that struck me, and this is more in an overall sense, is, you know, you structure a speech where you have kind of specific subject areas to go to. And in fact, I think I was watching it on ABC, and they actually had like the checklist of which. But I'm glad they had that on the screen, because he would end one subject and go right into the next one, and there was no stopping point. And I found that to be disorienting and basically disjointed.
Okay, so the State of the Union address generally can be a laundry list. There's going to be all kinds of different proposals that are made. And so that makes them hard to keep coherent. And so over time, different presidents have had different techniques for trying to do that. Obama would come with a theme every year that he would open the speech with and close it with, maybe with a story of some kind. But they're always unwieldy. The difference here was Trump's delivery. Because in a lot of those places, there are natural breakpoints that he was just blowing through. So if you were to look at speeches over time, the transitions might not be that clear in prior State of the Union addresses. But there were a couple of times where, having watched the speech and then watching it again, I had to play it back in sections because he had just blown through what should have been just a pause.
A natural break,
and then moving on to the next section, and he just didn't do that.
Well, and you know, obviously he stuck to script, and stuck to the teleprompter, which, you know, these days, you know, people give him credit for not deviating.
Well done, man.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, yeah, it was a very good speech because he stuck to the script.
Yeah, this is teleprompter Trump versus Twitter Trump. He's very conventional when it comes to the State of the Union address. It's one of the few things in any aspect of the presidency. Yeah, but from a communication standpoint, it's one of the few things that he is conventional about. One of the reasons that I think he wanted to end the shutdown was he wanted to get into the House in order to give the State of the Union address. He had no interest in giving that speech anywhere else, despite all of his threats to the contrary. That's where he wanted to be because of the spectacle of it. I did feel
And the fact that the focus is on him.
Oh, completely. Completely. And he plays that up very theatrical moves to the left and right to different parts of the gallery and gesturing up. I did think he handled the theatrics of it more effectively this year than he had last year.
I thought the props were good.
The people.
Yes.
Yes.
The people props were good.
They were good, but then also, of course, the other aspect of that is those props, those people were not the only people, the only symbols communicating in that room. And so he wasn't controlling all of that. Certainly the women that were there who were dressed in white and then sort of stole a moment from him were also doing that. And that's appropriate in the sense that this is a speech that is not only one that has a constitutional component.
Right.
Article 2 of the Constitution says the president will give information on the State of the Union to the Congress from time to time. Doesn't have to be a speech. It started being a speech again with Woodrow Wilson. But even when Wilson did it for the symbolic value of signaling bipartisanship, that he wanted to come over, inter-branch comedy between the branches. So there's always been a ceremonial component to this speech. It's a ritual. And in a ritual, many people communicate. And so the props that you mentioned, Rick, the people that are up there in the gallery, since Ronald Reagan put Lenny Skutnik up there in 1982, are one aspect of that. But then, of course, now we have all the guests of people attending. So that we had all these members of the Illinois congressional delegation, and Elizabeth Warren brought a guest, and all these furloughed workers.
I mean,
that's
a ritual now.
And that's designed to communicate things too, right? So you have sort of this continuum of communication that's going there, people trying to influence the audience at home. And that makes it for a really rich experience from a communications aspect and from a persuasion aspect.
I want to ask you, I mean, obviously on Twitter and in some of the post-game commentary, and I watched it, and I spent special attention not only looking and listening to the president, but also at Nancy Pelosi behind him.
Yes.
And kind of seeing how she was cueing the Democratic members. But someone said about how, well, the Democrats basically sat on their hands. Now, I didn't necessarily find that to be the case. I frankly saw them joining in the applause more often than I expected. I mean, I would have expected them to sit on their hands. But I don't think they really did.
No, I don't think they did any more than has been typical in the past few years. And also, in some of those shots that I noted, there were some members of the Democratic side that would stand while
on
others
their
would
own.
Not. Chuck Schumer stood a few times for some things while other people did not. So there are differences, and even that has a communications aspect. You remember a few years ago, that Republicans and Democrats were talking about whether they were going to sit together.
Yes, right.
To symbolize, to communicate the idea of bipartisanship and working together. I did not find the applause part of it to be particularly noteworthy one way or the other.
But you did hear that same kind of criticism.
A little bit. I thought there was more of a focus on Pelosi and kind of her theatrical movements through the speech and these comically large pieces of paper.
Well, she does kind of contrast to Mike Pence, you know. There, it's not hard to look outsized when you've got Mike Pence.
Well, I mean, he is a dynamo. I mean, he's not.
I was going to say, what? Right. You're the specialist on rhetoric. What message sending are you doing there?
Stillness.
Stillness.
It's a rhetoric of calm.
Calm. That's it. Exactly. Jason DeSanto is with us. He's senior lecturer at Northwestern University. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Skyline studio with Northwestern University's Jason DeSanto. We're talking about the State of the Union address and the messaging going on in that. And we mentioned about Nancy Pelosi. And one of the things that Democrats, as part of their investigations, one thing is clear. They also want to look at the president's tax returns. And in a press conference after the State of the Union address, Pelosi recounted a conversation that she had had with a hotel worker about the public's desire to see the president's taxes.
It was on Martin Luther King Day in San Francisco, going through the kitchen to go to the event for the breakfast, and one of the people working in the kitchen said to me, I have to tell you this. When the president says that the Mueller investigation is going on too long, you just say back to him, not as long as your tax audit, Mr. President. I thought those were words of wisdom.
That's Nancy Pelosi. I think that's a pretty good line.
It's a very good line. The president has never been particularly consistent about a number of things, and that's one of them. And, of course, during the speech, he, having recounted great economic success as he sees it, claiming credit for most of that, then went on to say, essentially, if you want more of that, we need to stop with these investigations. And not only that, we need to stop with the investigations so that we're united at home so that we can be strong abroad. And that is a kind of a theme. And I'll say two things about that, Rick. First of all, it hurts his long-term credibility because it's not consistent, although I don't think he's ever been
worried about that.
But the second part of it is it's also something that we generally hear. It's a rhetoric of authoritarianism. Protect the leader and you will be protected. And that is a consistent theme. You know, thinking about that State of the Union address, there were takeaways for the immediate term, 2019, the short term, 2020, and then the long term. And the immediate term was, I think Trump was admitting he had lost the shutdown. He talked not at all about the shutdown, but still maintained that walls will work, still maintained his position on the border. And so what I think that signifies is he's going to lose the shutdown but claim victory. And if you look at some of the negotiations that are going on now, there's this semantic debate about what it is that's actually going to be in the final legislation.
It's a barrier, a wall, a levee wall.
Yeah, right. A whole host of names. And so there'll be enough there that he'll claim that it was the right thing. That's 2019. 2020, essentially, I take it that it's a reset of his brand while carrying the baggage that he's always carried. And the baggage is, he just has very little credibility with large swaths of the American electorate. The number of people who would be willing to say, forget it, wake me up in an hour when Stacey Abrams starts talking is a pretty high number, but his brand was reset. And that is what that State of the Union address, particularly the year before an election, can do. 1995, Bill Clinton, coming off being thumped in the 94 midterms, came back and reset on a very moderate course, talking about opportunity, talking about responsibility, talking about welfare reform, crime reform, those things.
School uniforms.
School uniforms, and then into 96. And this was that kind of a speech, approximately the same length, about an hour and 20 minutes, just like Clinton did in 95. But there were the same themes about anti-immigration, anti-free trade, and to some extent anti-government, fused with the economy and these trappings of patriotism with World War II. Colloquially, we call that populism. And that was his coalition. That's the medium term. Long term, for the history books, this is the rhetoric of authoritarianism consistently. And that goes all the way back. There is something to fear, and I will protect you from the fear. And that is a departure from what most presidents do in these ceremonial addresses, State of the Union addresses, inaugural addresses, where the talk is about citizenship and common bonds. That's what Obama talked about. That's what Reagan talked about. Shining city on a hill was all of us participating in the hill. That's not the rhetoric that Trump uses. The rhetoric that Trump uses is there is something that is scary. MS-13 is out there. In the inaugural address, it was about American carnage. There was more about MS-13 in this speech. And as he said in the convention speech in 2016, I alone can fix it. And that is a very leader-centric kind of rhetoric. And it's very consistent with being not transparent about tax returns, making sure that nobody is able to get the things that I have so that I can continue to protect you. Don't question me so that you will be kept safe. And that's a consistent theme. It's very much consistent with what leaders like Viktor Orban in Hungary are doing around the world. And on the one hand, we call that populism. And on the other hand, it's a hard-edged populism, which is really authoritarianism in terms of rhetoric.
And as I played in that initial cut, too, that casting these investigations as, you know, vengeance, that same kind of, you know, trying to immediately, now obviously if you're being the one being investigated, you're going to try to assail the credibility of an investigation.
Sure.
But to kind of cast it as a, you know, as a move of vengeance.
Well, and that was the extra level. So when you think about crisis rhetoric and presidents that are being investigated, there are two examples in the past that we can point to relatively recently in the last generation or so. One is Nixon and one is Clinton. So Nixon in 1974 said 1 year of Watergate is enough. Bill Clinton in 98 and 99 during Lewinsky just cited a bunch of economic statistics. And basically the implied argument was you never had it so good. Trump did both. He basically said, we've got all these great economic indicators here. And oh, by the way, if you want to maintain that, you got to stop the investigation. Basically, 2 years of Bob Mueller is enough, was essentially the argument. And that had the threatening component to it.
Well, and you also had him say to the words the effect of, you know, if I wasn't standing here, we'd be in a depression. We'd be in a war.
We'd be in a war with North Korea. And that's the other thing, right? Fear and protection. Those are the two pieces of the rhetoric. We would be in this terrible war, but for my existence. And that was the point at which the reaction was laughter.
Exactly. Room, right? Yes, yes, yes. I want to switch gears in the closing seconds that we have to talk about the mayoral race, obviously, now just a couple of weeks away. And I wanted to get your thoughts on what you're seeing from the candidates as far as their messaging, from the TV ads to what they're saying in the debates.
Multi-candidate debate, multi-candidate race, compressed time, it makes the messaging, to me, fascinating because there are two goals of it. It's both simple and complex. The simple part of it is just name recognition for large swaths of the Chicago electorate that doesn't know a lot of these people. That's where money helps, being able to get up on TV and having a good ground game, being able to go door-to-door and talk to people. The complex part is distinguishing from each other. And what we have is a struggle of these candidates to do that, and it's coming into sharper focus because of the ads that we're seeing, but also because the debates are becoming more frequent. They've been in forums for the last 6 weeks, about 30, yes. 35 of them, but now they're really in a format where there are fewer of them that are in each of them, and they're allowed to go after each other. And so this is where candidates are really beginning to find the contrast. And what we see is contrast about all sorts of things. And contrast has to be believable. You have to be the most trusted candidate on that particular issue. Polling tells you only so much. Polling will tell you what's most important to the electorate. But what campaigns often miss is you've got to say why you, out of 8 candidates, 10 candidates, 14, are the most credible on that issue. So you think about the 4 issues in this race that are the largest. Crime, corruption, schools, and the budget. Right? Those are really the 4. They're all saying essentially the same thing, some slight differences on each of those. The difference is that the one that's been in the news every day is corruption. Right. And that's the one that's driving coverage. That's the one that's driving cameras. So that's why it's a bunch of people saying, Ed Burke, never heard of him. Who is that guy? You know, never heard of Danny Solis. And that has put a couple of these candidates on the defensive. It's made it hard for them to affirmatively put their messages out, to define themselves. It's hurt Mendoza. It's driven her numbers down. It's driven down Preckwinkle. Preckwinkle is essentially running as the incumbent. right. in this race. She's the one that's being targeted the most by the others. And so you have this situation where all these candidates are trying to define themselves but are being defined by the corruption issue and kind of surrounding that. And that means in the last 2 or 3 weeks, you're going to have candidates shooting off in all directions, particularly because the goal here is to finish in the top two and get to the runoff. So you're going to have candidates who are trying to identify themselves as progressives, not just shooting at the candidates who are perceived as the establishment, but as the other person in the progressive lane. So Lori Lightfoot, for example, has gone after Tony Preckwinkle. You're not a progressive. If you're trying to define yourself based on gender, same thing. Lightfoot goes after Preckwinkle. Mendoza goes after Preckwinkle. And then you have candidates like Bill Daley, who are establishment candidates, but are trying to message to different groups to cobble together enough of a percentage to get the second. So what does he do in the past week? He rolls out an endorsement from Bobby Rush for the African-American community. He rolls out Howard Dean and Al Gore for establishment, but also progressives. And then, even when he doesn't show up for the debate, he makes sure that everybody knows that he didn't go to the debate because he got a union endorsement. So for blue-collar workers, right? So even that was a way to signal and symbolize how broad the support was.
And it all comes down to whatever minuscule percentage is going to be enough to make that runoff. And
yeah.
I mean, that could be 15%. I mean, that's how varied this field really is.
All you have to do is get to number two. And so because of that, I expect that Preckwinkle will continue to get a lot of attacks, particularly during the debates that are left. And she has not been a particularly adept debater to this point. And I expect that Mendoza will continue to go after Daley because it helps her with establishment. It helps her in terms of the gender dynamics of that debate. It helps her with her generational claims. And I would also expect Chico to go after Daley a little bit more on the commuter tax because the recent polling has shown Chico at number three and Daley at number two. So he needs to go after Daley, and I think we'll probably hear that.
Stay tuned for more. Jason DeSanto, senior lecturer at Northwestern University. Always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Rick. Great to be here.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. I'm Rick Pearson, the Chicago Tribune. Welcome to the second hour of your Sunday Spin. I'm here in the Allstate Skyline studio and joined by some very special guests. One, a familiar voice, I think, to folks who've listened to the show, Martha Jo Black. She is an author, and she's also involved with fan experiences of the Chicago White Sox. We also have Stephanie Carew. Stephanie Carew, the daughter of Hall of Famer Rod Carew, and also runs Carew Concierge Services. You notice how he's got the French accent on concierge. And also, we have Patty Green. Patty's the daughter of football great Dennis Green, and she owns Endeavor Integrated Marketing. And ladies, thank you so much for joining me this morning. Martha, we have kind of it's an annual visit to commemorate Black History Month. And, you know, from the moment I talked to you, even before you had written your book, Joe Black, about your father, More Than a Dodger, I mean, we just hit it right off. And you know, then the book was still kind of conceptual at that point. It's like, how do I write a book? Kind of
right,
thing.
Right.
And I love the book. And I consistently love the book. It came out in 2015. It's available at Amazon. But, I mean, it is a love story and an ode to your father, but not in the way you might think. I mean, it's very biographical, but as we've talked so many times, just the fact that, you know, just for what he did in baseball, first
right.
African-American to win a World Series as pitcher, MVP in the National League, this 1957 we're talking about, right? 52, sorry. Didn't mean, but
he left in 57.
Okay, so. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
But just those baseball exploits are enough. But
yeah.
Then the whole post career afterwards, and you know his presence in the African American community. I mean, first African American executive for a major transportation company was at Greyhound.
Correct.
Writing in Ebony. I mean, just kind of a touchstone for a very interesting time in America.
No, I mean, he definitely stepped in and did a lot in the African-American community because he felt that we all need to be treated equally. And so he did the By the Ways, as you mentioned, that were in Ebony and Jet magazine. Johnny Johnson was my dad's mentor that started those magazines. And he just wanted to reach out to people. He didn't always write things, excuse me, that people liked on his articles, because he was telling them the truth. He wasn't saying you were owed 40 acres and a mule. He said you have to work. You have to be on time at work. You need to give your best in everything that you do. And that's what he relayed to me. I'm very fortunate. My father raised me as a single parent. He said, I can do this. Just because I'm a man doesn't mean I can't raise my daughter. And he instilled that in me. He goes, if you want something, you go for your dream.
Well, and Patty, I mean, one of the things that we talk about is, you know, just kind of stereotypes that exist about the African-American or brown community, about, you know, dysfunctional families, single parents, that kind of thing. And one of those things is that the father typically comes off as a bad guy.
Yeah.
And is absentee.
Yeah, no, well, I would definitely dispute that, but, you know, I'm very close to my dad, but I just listening to Martha talk about her dad, it's really interesting. Generationally speaking, my dad's a product of the 60s, so he's coming up behind a Joe Black who's set this precedence of, you know, paying it forward almost. Then comes my dad in the 60s, and he's starting his coaching career. I came along when my dad was very young. My dad went to the University of Iowa back in the 60s. I was also born in the 60s. And, you know, I'm a daddy's girl through and through. My dad really, you know, went to school and took it to heart that he was going to, you know, back in the 60s, it was still not an opportunity everybody had to, as a young African American, to go to a Big Ten school or to an NCAA school. So for him to go and do that and then take me, my mom, along with him, my brother came along later, and then decide to dedicate himself to, you know, well, I guess probably first love was I'd love to play pro football, but that wasn't in the cards for him. So coaching came along. But he had a similar philosophy as Joe Black, is that, you know, it's I'm going to pay this forward now. I'm going to pave the way for and guide young men, not just African-American men, but men in general, to their future, to get them to a place where they can get to college and use football as a way to do that as well. So
we're speaking with Martha Jo Black, Stephanie Carew, and Patty Green. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, the Chicago Tribune, here in the Allstate Skyline studio, joined by Martha Jo Black, Stephanie Carew, and Patty Green. We're kind of talking about this, our usual annual segment where we honor Black History Month. And one of the things we're talking about is Martha Jo, her book about her dad, Joe Black, which, by the way, Ron, our favorite caller, called in to say one of the best books that he's read.
Thank
so
you, Ron.
I know you'd appreciate
yes,
that.
Yes, I do appreciate that.
But we were talking about dads. But, I mean, Stephanie, I mean, it's not just fathers. I mean, it's about family and family being very important in the Black and brown community because of the unusual challenges that those communities face.
Absolutely. You know, there's strong women that are holding down the fort, you know, and that's kind of what my situation was with my family. You know, my dad traveled all the time, which, you know, it was great, but, you know, we had my mom at home to support us and kind of take us to all of our softball games and everywhere we needed to go. So it was just nice to be able to, like, have that comfort of family. And then you have, like, a community of friends that really become your family, too, just to kind of help support, you know, my mom, like, at home with, like, three young kids and things like that. So it kind of, it does take a village.
Yes.
Well, and when you say community of support, I mean, are those other families in the sports community? Or
yeah,
those
it's families in similar situations where you, you know, other athletes and the wives and the kids and the families kind of get together to support each other. But it's also really the friendships that you build. Like, we had a very close group of my mom had some great friends in Southern California and even in Minnesota, back in Minnesota where I was born. And, you know, they support you from start to finish, and you just build those relationships, and then they're still there now.
Actually, I wanted to let you know, and I texted my Aunt Jo up in Minnesota to say that you were going to be on, and Patty, that you were going to be on, because I have to always say
the Minnesota connection.
Yes, I have the Minnesota
component.
I have
no Minnesota connection. Oh, my gosh.
Except for purple. Yes, I have you in purple. My dad was an Omega. That's purple.
Okay, all right. Fair enough. So, you know, you Stephanie, you talk about, you know, strong women. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was a time when that was a bad thing.
Well, yes.
That was like a negative, and that's a criticism. I have to tell you, ladies, you are strong women. And
thank you.
Also, but I mean that in a most sincere way, and as a father of two daughters, and that actually shapes things as well. Not that I would ever win any Father of the Year award from my daughters, because I too traveled a lot in presidential campaigns and things like that. And they had a, you know, their mom was just terrific in basically raising them when I couldn't be there. But you get that appreciation for, you know, at a time where we talk about the struggles in the black and brown community, then you have the added hurdle of being a woman too. I mean, right. And the challenges that, I mean, how do you overcome that, Patty?
Yeah, I think, well, my dad did raise a strong woman. He always wanted me to be able to be self-sufficient. And, you know, our family, I have two brothers and a sister, and was raised, his thing was the three D's, desire, dedication, and determination. And if you have the three D's, regardless of what you're aiming for, you will be successful. And that's how I grew up. Just, you can be whatever you want to be, set your mind to it. And I've kind of always carried that with me, that there's no limits. And I think growing up a coach's daughter, moving around a lot from place to place to place, you do kind of, you look at things a little bit different. You have to go for it. You know, you don't just sit in one location and get stagnant. You've got to, you know, you move every 4 years, so you pick up, you go, and you kind of just, you just go for it every time. And I think that I've just carried that with me into my adulthood, that there are no limits for me, and, you know, I'm gonna do what I want to do, and I'm gonna do it for myself. And, you know, it just kind of got to do what you got to do.
Well, and Stephanie, I mean, getting instilled with that kind of, you know, go for it kind of attitude is very important.
Yes. Especially growing up the daughter of a, you know, famous baseball player, you know, you kind of have to prove yourself.
Well, you weren't so shabby as an athlete either, by the way.
Well,
I should point out,
I did have the best hitting coach. He taught me everything I know. I'm very grateful for that, because I was able to play softball all through college, very successfully, and that was really fun for me. But, you know, it's just, you have to prove yourself, you know, because you're so-and-so's daughter. So people kind of think that you're given something.
Yes.
And then that just kind of builds a strength within yourself, because it's like, no, I can do this because this is who I am. And so
being your own person.
Absolutely.
Right. I mean, that is one of the most difficult things. Everyone's like, oh, you must have played softball. I did not. I ran track, but
they got you confused with stuff.
Yeah, they do. They totally do. And they're like, well, you'd be a great pitcher. I was like, well, no, I ran track. My godfather happened to be Jesse Owens. They were like, oh, okay. I was like, yeah, that's my Uncle Jesse. So I was like, but that's because I wanted to do that.
You had 8 million uncles.
I do. I do. I have from Don Newcomb to Lou Johnson to Pete. Yeah, please. I have so many.
No, but it is that having to prove yourself, isn't it, is the essential part. But that has to also, is that something you have to figure out on your own, or is that something that comes from, you know, instilled in that family and community?
I think it's just instilled from, like, the family and the community, and you get that support, which gives you strength, which then just kind of keeps you going. So, you know, I got that at home. You get that through the, you know, your friends, you know, that extended family, and the people that really know who you are as a person, and they're the ones that kind of give you that support all the way through, which, I don't know, it just was very nice growing up to have that, which, you know, gave me the strength to continue to start my own business and move to a different city and do all these things. And then now here I am on the radio with you.
And you're doing such a great job.
Oh, gosh.
I second the emotion. Martha Jo Black, fan experiences at the White Sox. How can they get a hold of you?
Definitely. You can call the Chicago White Sox Monday through Friday because we're not working every day of the week yet. At 312-674-1000 and ask for me. I'm the only Martha that's there. The fan experiences are great. They get you a little bit closer into the game. You can get on the field to watch batting practice before the gates open. You could work with Roger Bossert, a.k.a. Sodfather, that even did Wrigley Field.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And you can be part of the grounds crew, or you can even, if you really want to do something big, you can have dinner or lunch with Jerry Reinsdorf.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, you never know. I mean, the bars room's kind of fancy.
Well, you know. Here at WGN, we're very proud to be partners with our baseball partners, the Chicago White Sox. Martha, thank you so much. Stephanie Carew Concierge Services.
Yes.
How can they learn more information about that?
They can go to www.stephcarew.com, StephCarew.com.
Okay, and Patty Green, Endeavor Integrated Marketing, where can they find out more information about that?
You can visit Endeavor Marketing. So it's endeavor-mkdg.com.
Ladies, thank you so much for joining me this morning. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much for having us on.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. We're talking at the start of the show about the forgettable Super Bowl that occurred last Sunday. But there was one thing that I thought was kind of memorable. Super Bowl always gets its attention, a lot of attention for its advertising. There was a unique ad in the fourth quarter. It was an ad from the Washington Post, and its narrator was Tom Hanks.
When we go off to war, when we exercise our rights, when we soar to our greatest heights, when we mourn and pray, when our neighbors are at risk, when our nation is threatened, there's someone to gather the facts, to bring you the story, no matter the cost. Because knowing empowers us. Knowing helps us decide. Knowing keeps us free.
Now, that was an ad for the Washington Post, but I think it speaks to the larger message of what journalism is all about. So, Jeff Bezos, thank you for paying all the big bucks for that ad. It's much appreciated. Well, joining me now on the phone is my Chicago Tribune colleague, David Heinzman, from the Tribune's watchdog investigative team. And I wanted to have David on to talk about a story he did recently as we've been taking a look at who are these people who want to be the next mayor of Chicago. Dave, thanks so much for joining me this morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. I'm very good. I hope you're doing good as well. You wrote a story about Amara Enya. And for most people, I think it's fair to say, she's an unknown. She has gained attention for having gotten support from Chance the Rapper, Kanye West, is appealing, very much appealing to a more youthful segment of a voting populace that we don't know whether they're going to vote or not. But you kind of took a step back and looked into her background and found some very curious, if not perhaps troubling, issues regarding her personal finances. Could you kind of let us know what you found?
Yeah, well, first that I would agree. She was very much an unknown for most of Chicago, I think, until Chance the Rapper endorsing her in October immediately put her on the map, and suddenly everybody had to pay attention to her. And I mean, all the other candidates who probably weren't, too much worried about a candidacy from her because she was such an unknown. Suddenly, you know, she mattered. So she is a what she calls a public policy consultant, and she's got an interesting background. She actually grew up in University Park, which is way down in the south suburbs, and then Frankfurt. Her parents are both academics. They're both sort of administrators and teachers at Lewis University, which is in the southwest suburbs in Romeoville. And she went to the University of Illinois, and she's got a journalism degree and had more than one major and has a law degree and a PhD in education policy. And she finished up those graduate degrees around 2009, 2010, and since then has been, you know, kind of working around a bunch of community organizations in the city, mostly in African-American communities in the south and west sides and the south suburbs. But as, you know, kind of a big benchmark time for her was when the Village of University Park, which is a really, it's a small, but it's really deeply troubled financially, hired her to be the village manager in May of 2017. And she really didn't have any relevant experience for that. I used to cover suburbs for many years, and village managers, it's a profession, you know, it's a fairly complicated job, and it was her first brush with it, and this thing didn't go well. She immediately, you know, they started squabbling over how much she should be paid. Her initial offer was to be paid $180,000 in a $15,000 a month contract, and the village board, you know, their reaction was, you're crazy. There's no way we can afford that. So they fought over that. There were questions about whether or not she was spending any time in Village Hall. She was sort of doing the job remotely, and she was doing the job while she maintained other consulting clients. So by July, you know, things had really soured. So just a couple of months on the job there, and by August, they had a separation agreement, and she went away.
And as you say, you know, village manager, it's almost like a profession in itself. You see people going from communities to communities, you know, it's kind of a ladder climb.
It depends on the place, but it's a, you know, you're running a municipality. It's it is a serious management job, and you would need to bring some experience to that. And so anyway, she... the thing I wrote about this week, though, the lead of the story had to do with her real difficulty in paying income tax. And when I started to add up what she made in 2017 from, you know, the public sources we could find, which was her separation agreement with University Park, which paid her $31,000, and a consulting relationship with an organization called Kids First Chicago, which paid her $3,000 a month for part of the year. And then she worked for Chris Kennedy's campaign as a consultant. And I knew from state filings that, campaign finance filings, that the Chris Kennedy campaign paid her $21,000 in 2017. However, when she finally gave us her tax return after resisting doing it for more than a month, the numbers didn't add up. She claimed $42,000 in income for 2017, and it was clear that she made about $62,000. So she had left out the Chris Kennedy portion of her income.
Here's where I think it gets even more interesting, because then when you present this question to her, you get different answers.
I did, and I should add first that this isn't the first time she's misstated her income on her taxes. She had an existing tax lien that showed that she had misreported her income and owed taxes for four previous years, 2011, 12, 13, and 15. Her first answer to me about the 2017 taxes was that the reason this happened is because the Kennedy campaign didn't produce a tax form to her in a timely fashion, which I talked to four different tax lawyers before doing this story, and the form she's talking about is a 1099 form, and that's for forms of income other than wages. So, you know, a contractor, a consultant, if you take money from stock dividends or whatever, that kind of payment, you'll get a 1099 form, and it's it's a form you report to the government, and then you have to pay the taxes. The taxes aren't taken out. And she hadn't paid that. But all the tax lawyers I talked to said, you know, you have to report your income regardless of whether or not you have a 1099 form in hand. And but as over the course of talking about that with her, it finally became clear that she probably did have the 1099 form. She just forgot to give it to her tax preparer. That was her eventual story. Whether or not she actually forgot or omitted it on purpose, we don't know. She says she forgot. But now we have a pretty troubling pattern of fees and fines and penalties. I mean, in addition to her tax problems, she also had this problem that that Bill Ruthart, our colleague, uncovered on day one of the Chance endorsement, was that she owed the Illinois State Board of Elections $73,000 in fines for not filing campaign finance reports from the last time she ran for mayor. And that was in 2015, and that really was a sort of long-shot bid with no support from anybody famous, and very few people may have known about it when she did that. But she didn't follow the rules of disclosing campaign donations then, and piled up these crazy fees. And you know, on a couple of days after we reported that, Kanye West gave her a big donation to cover those fees. So, and she's, you know, other things that included.
Well,
you know,
hold on right there, because I want to get to those, but we need to take a quick break. We're speaking with David Heinzman from the Chicago Tribune investigative team. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson from the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Skyline studio, joined on the phone by my good friend and colleague David Heinzman from the Tribune's investigative team. We're talking about Amara Enya, who is one of the 13 candidates for mayor of Chicago, who has kind of gotten this great deal of attention with Chance the Rapper's support, and is really trying to appeal to youthful voters. But as David points out in a recent story, she's asking voters to elect her to run a city with an $8.9 billion budget, yet has some very curious financial problems. And before the break, you were going to even elaborate more than just on issues about questions about her income tax payments.
Yeah, so there are other issues that she's had that really are personal finance issues. She's been sued for student loans, and she was sued, her landlord at one point tried to evict her for not paying the rent. And one of the things that I'd like to point out is, in her response to me, I had this long hour-and-a-half conversation with her last, not this past Friday, but the Friday before the story ran. And what she wanted to do was to sort of conflate financial struggles that many people experience with underreporting her income on her taxes. And, you know, at one point she said, you know, these tax issues that we're talking about are very familiar to a lot of low-wage people. And I said, you know, I don't think you want to say that poor people are more likely to misfile their taxes, because I don't think it's true. And she said, I'm not saying that. But in the response to the story, a lot of what her campaign has done is to say, you know, these are really relatable issues, and to kind of blend together a person who doesn't make much money struggling to pay what she owes in with a person who doesn't make a lot of money not reporting a chunk of that income and not paying taxes on it. And I think that's maybe a dangerous strategy, because most of the response to the story has been, hey, wait a minute, I don't make that much money, and I, you know, somehow manage to pay my taxes. A lot of the reader response, I mean. So, but there is this idea that you know, she's been trying to promote that this is really just an outgrowth of the fact that she's chosen to work in, you know, in kind of serving communities and hasn't made a lot of money. And when you know, she also said to me, just because I can't manage my personal finances doesn't mean I can't, or if you're saying that just because I can't manage my personal finances, I can't manage the city's finances, I think that's a faulty bar. And I think a lot of people won't think that that is a faulty bar, that that's a, you know, fairly serious question.
Well, and I think, you know, you've got that issue. And quite frankly, you know, there's kind of the buzzword that we hear in politics about transparency.
Right. I mean, she did not want to release Bill Ruthart asked for all the candidates' tax returns on November 1st and said, please provide them to us by December 1st. And then he wrote a story summarizing what was in everybody's tax returns on December 13th. And it wasn't until 3 weeks after that story ran that she finally released her tax returns. And not to us at first. Ruthart had to call her or call her campaign and say, hey, you gave these to other people and not to us. So she didn't want, and she made statements at the time, she really didn't want to release her tax returns because she viewed it as establishment, you know, beating up on poor people. But that's not really obviously what was going on in her tax returns. And I should also say that when she did release her tax returns to us in January, she claims that she already knew that she hadn't, that she had misreported her income. So she knew that she was releasing to us an incorrect document. Whether or not she really had, you know, dealt with that or had that conversations with her accountant about the fact that she had misreported her income, I don't know. But by her own admission, her own claim, she had released to the public a document about her taxes that she knew was incorrect.
And a document that she also filed knowing it was incorrect.
Oh, yeah, there's no question about that. She told the IRS that she made $42,000 a year when she clearly was paid $62,000 a year. And, you know, one of the other things that all these many tax lawyers I talked to said, you're not going to get away with that because the Kennedy campaign issued a 1099 form. So it's not like, you know,
there's only one copy of this. It also goes, the 1099 also goes to the IRS.
Right. And it's not like, you know, the overworked, undervalued IRS in this moment in our national politics is not going to catch it. It's, you know, a computer is going to catch that. A computer is going to match up or not match up the declared income with the existence of this 1099. And the computer is going to say, hey, where's this $21,000? So for somebody who had just gone through this and been snagged by the IRS in previous years, to have an oversight, as she put it, this egregious is enough to give people pause, I think.
Well, and as you say, you know, this is, having done it in the past, you know, there is, obviously, you can see that there appears to be a pattern that exists.
Yeah, and that's one of the lawyers said, yeah, there's clearly a pattern here, and this pattern's not good, you know, for what it says.
Right.
So, yeah.
Well, David, so, you know. thank you so much for joining me this morning, and thank you so much for your fine reporting. And you can find David's story about Amara Enya's tax issues and those kinds of things. You can find that at ChicagoTribune.com. David, thanks for joining me.
My pleasure. Thanks, Rick.